Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all very much for joining us to learn firsthand about the Fulbright Scholar experience. My name is Athena Misson-Poulet. I am the Fulbright Scholar Program Outreach and Recruitment Manager here at the Institute of International Education, and I am joined by three fantastic and distinguished scholars in their own right, who are also our Fulbright Scholar Alumni Ambassadors, to share a little bit about their time abroad, as well as insights into the application process, and just a general free-flowing conversation about the Fulbright experience. So thanks again for joining. I have put the presentation up online there. If you have any questions, please feel free to go ahead and type that in the chat box, and we're going to have a colleague, Ginny, will be monitoring that, and we'll be answering them as we can and as we go along. And if you're having any issues in terms of hearing us, please just raise your hand as well in the attendees section or the chat box, and we can also make sure that you are heard that way. And just to let you know that this will be archived and posted on our website within a couple of days too, so the whole conversation will be recorded should you want to refer to it at another time. So great. Fantastic. I'd like to allow, I'm going to hand the floor over to a couple of our colleagues, starting with Shirley McLaughlin, and then maybe go around in circle to Brian and Bruce with just some short introductions of who you are. Thank you.
Hi, this is Shirley McLaughlin. Hello to everyone. I'm a professor of education and women and gender studies at King State College in King, New Hampshire. And I did a Fulbright in the Republic of Georgia, a teaching Fulbright in education in Telavi, Georgia in 2013.
Great. Thank you, Shirley. Brian?
All right, there we go. Yeah, I'm Brian Psycho. Yes, it's really pronounced that way. The other panelists know. Don't be afraid and hang up your go-to meeting. But in 2003, I went with my family to Taiwan. And my background is all in theater, as a theater professor, and that's what I went there to work on. I worked at the America Center. And about 17 years ago, too, I shifted over into enrollment and admissions. So actually for 17 years I've been a VP of enrollment management. That's why you see that now starting that part about Community College of Allegheny County. I was at small private colleges before, and now I'm at a large public community college.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Bruce? Bruce, you're muted. There you go.
You got me? All right. Can you hear me now?
All right.
Hi. Bruce Michelson. I'm an emeritus professor of English American Literature and former director of the Campus Honors Program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I did a Fulbright very happily at the University of Antwerp in 2014. It was American Literature with an interest especially in wit and humor. And thousands of years before most of you guys were born, back in the 1980s, I had another Fulbright when I was young and furry and still, you know, untenured. And that was at the universities of Ghent, Brussels, and Liège, also in Belgium, 30 years before, also American Literature. It sounds like a lot of work. It wasn't. We'll get back to that.
Fantastic. Thank you. We appreciate the honesty. So I'm going to get us started with just some brief background. I know the focus of what a lot of us are going to be talking about today is going to be opportunities for U.S. faculty and U.S. administrators to go abroad through the Fulbright Scholar Program. But we might have a pretty diverse audience of people who just sort of stumbled upon this and want to learn more information. So we just want to make sure we share some consistent information across all of our venues and audiences. So the Fulbright program, next year we're celebrating the 75th anniversary, and so we were created in 1946 in partnership with countries all over the world. So at the heart of the Fulbright mission is this concept of binational relationships and in working with those countries to make sure that we provide opportunities for passionate and accomplished faculty, administrators, artists, journalists, lawmakers, lawyers, excuse me, and other professionals from all backgrounds to study, teach, or conduct research on Fulbright grants. And the heart, again, of that mission is to foster mutual understanding between nations, advance knowledge across communities, and improve lives around the world. So basically, our conversation today is really going to focus around those three points. We're going to hear from our speakers about how they thought about the Fulbright program and any tips they have about applying, and again, some of that long-term impact of how Fulbright has really continued to shape their personal lives and their career. The Fulbright program is sponsored by U.S. taxpayer dollars appropriated through the Department of State, with contributions as well from foreign governments, and the Institute of International Education is the nonprofit organization that has had the honor of administering both the scholar and student program since its inception. And one more slide to discuss and share. This is a very important slide, and we want to make sure that we take time to discuss it and share it in every session that we give. But as the flagship academic and cultural exchange program of the United States government, what does that mean? That means a Fulbright should reflect what that United States looks like. So Fulbright strives to ensure that the program itself reflects the diversity of United States societies here. And on the reverse side, those foreign nationals coming to the United States, we want to make sure that we have involvement from people across all audiences, underrepresented, included in that, in all of our grants, programs, and initiatives. So that is defined by that language there. It's open to people regardless of their race, color, national origin, sex, age, religion, geographic location, socioeconomic status, disability, sexual orientation, or gender identity. So those two slides are a summary of who the program is and what we're trying to, what we're aspiring to be for as a program. Okay, so let's stay in the order that we started earlier. Let's talk a little bit about, that's enough for me, we want to hear now from our alumni ambassadors in terms of, can you talk a little bit about your path to Fulbright? So two leading questions here is, with 160 different countries that program is operating in, walk us through a little bit about the process of how you selected the country that you'd like to go to and selected the specific award that you ended up taking, whether it be teaching, research, or a combination of both. And I think it might be helpful to get your insights on picking your host institution. So you could do your research or teaching anywhere. How did you end up with the specific host that you ended up conducting your grant with? So Shirley, have some insights to share on that?
Okay, sure. I chose Georgia primarily looking initially at I did a lot of research looking at the impact of power and privilege and the role education played in it, and whether it perpetuates problems or improves social justice. And I happened to be doing a conference on diversity in Latvia. And when I was there, I saw different perceptions of the treatment of Russians after the Iron Curtain fell. The Latvians were then in power, and they represented about 60% of the population, and then 40% were Russians. And the Russians said they were pretty oppressed. They kind of switched positions from oppressor to oppressed. And so I was just curious, what is happening with the relationships between Russia in post-Soviet emerging democracies, what's happening in terms of oppression and things. So I wanted to go to another post-Soviet country, and I chose the Republic of Georgia. I also wanted to look at presenting ideas about alternative approaches to teaching instead of the totally lecture-banking concept of education that tended to be used by the Soviets. And I didn't push, you know, that this is the way to teach, but I was showing them other techniques, and they really enjoyed it. Georgia didn't need a letter of invitation, so it was easier, too. I was the chair of a huge department as I was trying to get my application together, so anything to make it a little easier was helpful. And I did a teaching grant because I tend to do my research when I'm in the midst of things, and I figured I would find plenty of opportunities to do research after the fact based on my experiences there. As far as choosing a host institution, I didn't really choose one. If I had to do it, I would choose by looking at institutions that had were welcoming in terms of the types of philosophy I had to education and materials like that. As it was in Georgia, I expected to be in the Tbilisi University, that's the capital, and instead I ended up in a small 30,000 beautiful city in the northeastern border of Georgia. It was called Telavi, and I worked at Telavi State University. It was the heart of wine country and at the base of the Caucasus Mountains, and it was beautiful there. I had no complaints whatsoever.
Fantastic.
I covered it. I think that covers the main ideas.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, that's an interesting. I to be honest, I've realized it now. I don't think I've heard that story, so thank you for letting us know. Brian, how about you? How did Taiwan come about? Oh, here we go. Sorry about that.
I feel so much better being unmuted. It feels released. well, you know, I often talk about my story was I didn't follow lots of the rules because I was I didn't know what to do. I didn't really ask for help. I kind of was following in my first generation background. You know, I just thought I'm kind of afraid to ask people, not sure what to do. And in 2003, it was the days in which there was the immense catalog of offerings. And so what I was, where I was, is I had sent so many students to travel abroad and work abroad that I thought, man, I have to do this because if I don't, somebody's going to ask someday and I won't be able to say I've done it. And so there I was amidst the cornfields of Illinois, and my family, my kids were in 8th grade, 6th grade, and preschool. And I decided, okay, this looks really awesome. And first of all, because it was paid for by the government, there was that part of me that had that first gen thing of somebody else is paying for this, so that's great. Separately, I was at a small school, and I knew they didn't really have the support for it necessarily. And so they ended up giving me support. But basically, I looked through the catalogs, and I knew my family was going. And when I looked at all the different awards and countries, the Asian countries, East Asia, Pacific region, it seemed especially supportive of families, you know, money for the kids to go to school, extra stipends for all of that. And I was looking for something that was the exact opposite of the cornfields. And so Taiwan, and I realized Taiwan, I try not to look at the places that maybe come across as like the top of the tourist mindset. And Taiwan is awesome because it's really the gateway to Asia. It's got the island culture, Southeast Asian culture. Japan ruled it for 50 years. Mainland China, the Han Chinese or main majority there really on the island. So you get kind of all of it packed in to a really a first world country, really. So within it, though, I still knew that somehow that wasn't radical enough, right, for Psycho. And so basically, I didn't want to just go to another huge city like Taipei, which was kind of like New York, where there would be enough people that spoke English that it would be easy. And so I looked and I saw there was an award, a school in Kaohsiung, which is in southern Taiwan, National Sun Yat-sen University. And basically, I kind of contacted, they had the opening was to work at an America Center, and they didn't list theater as one of the areas, but it was an all-discipline award. In other words, don't just look for your specific discipline, look at the all-discipline awards, and you convince them why it should be you and your discipline. And so basically, they wanted all this American cultural background, and I thought, well, theater does that for sure. So I just tried to convince them of it and expressed how a Fulbright to me would be times five, because my whole family would be going, and the impact that would have over time, and we'll get to that later. And so you know, basically, it was the host institution, it was people in the America Center that helped convince the host institution to host me and kind of write a letter. And so I tried 1 year, and I didn't get it. And then I went again the second year, and I tried, and I knew to work a little bit closer with that host institution to try to get the award. And all the people had written letters for me said, you have to try again. So I did, and that's when I got it the second year around. So I ended up in a completely different culture, And that's what I wanted to do, full immersion for myself and my family, and at an amazing institution where we lived on the side of a mountain overlooking the South China Sea and didn't see any corn. So there you go.
Good to go. No corn.
No corn.
That's great. Yeah, that's a pretty serendipitous way of that your host institution working out for you. So it's definitely a good piece of advice for those listening that, you know, at first you don't succeed, try again. But it is a good idea if you are going to be requesting affiliation as a host with a host institution. Try to line that up sooner rather than later and make sure you're on the same page. So thank you for that, Brian. And Bruce.
Yeah, hi. Shirley and Brian have already, you know, focused in nicely on a couple of key matters here. Let me take it one step farther and into something that might sound abstract or even fluffy, but I think it's important. For all of us, I think, who teach at colleges and universities, there's a need at some point for cultural refreshment, for stepping out, for breathing different air, for seeing the world with fresh eyes. And it's not just a kind of R&R therapy. It also helps you as a scholar and as a teacher. And the adrenaline jolt, the cultural boost that I've had on Fulbright experiences has been absolutely invaluable. Brian already hit on the fact that ultimately they choose you, and we'll get later on into how to choose a place where you're a good fit and how to make yourself maybe even a better fit in the process of applying and designing your program. But I chose Western Europe in part because my main racket has been Mark Twain for the last couple of years. I've done two books on Mark Twain, a bunch of articles, professional society, administration, things like that. And I'm constantly gassing off about how Mark Twain is an important global presence and how American culture transmits its way around the planet because of him, and so on and so forth. And I'm in an echo chamber professionally because what I hear back from is other Mark Twain scholars around the world who in many cases have studied with us and sort of speak on our frequency. I wasn't clear about how Mark Twain works these days with students, people who are not going to make a profession out of humor studies or American literature or anything like that, and how shifts in culture, even maybe nuanced ones, just between America and Western Europe, affect the reception and the appeal and the meaning of his work as it continues to resonate. So getting with students was tremendously important, and I came back with a lot of ideas on how humor doesn't move by fixed algorithms, but is subject to all sorts of wonderful contingencies, and that makes talking about it a lot more fun. I'll stop there.
Thank you. Yes, that's definitely a wonderful addition to Shirley and Brian's comments, this idea that, you know, getting out of your space and getting out of your echo chamber, as you so poetically put it, is important for scholars to just, again, get different perspectives and to reimagine how you communicate what you do to your students. So thank you for that. I'd like to move the conversation a little bit now to, I started with a very broad introduction of the mission of promoting mutual understanding and advancing knowledge across the field, but let's not forget that the Fulbright program is still very much a professional development opportunity. This is in many cases, once-in-a-lifetime grant to go abroad and really build those networks and connections with people in your field, or in some cases, people that you actually don't know very well, and sort of forge different paths and different research and teaching dimensions on. So can we all take, I'm going to go in reverse order, so let's start with you then, Bruce, with keep going to along with what you were saying, but now sort of divulge a little bit more about what you find were or are the benefits of the Fulbright grant in your personal and professional life. And just so that we also get a sense of what Belgium got out of it, can you discuss something that really impressed you about your colleagues and students?
Okay. Brian mentioned the importance to him. I don't think he wasn't being playful, I think, of looking out in the morning over his coffee or whatever he was drinking over the South China Sea and seeing a different world before him than the one he normally does. I'm still in the cornfields, and my wife and I love it. But the walking the streets, the going into museums and cultural byways, and hopping trains to unknown places, those things are enormously important. Let me say something risky here. Brian can and Shirley can shut me down if I get too far, but my impression is, having talked to a lot of other Fulbrighters and having served on some committees with the commission, nobody has ever come back complaining, how to put this, that the academic burden of a Fulbright is unbearable. Okay? To put it much more frankly, American professors and teachers work very, very hard compared to what goes on in many other places around the world. And if you're at a school which has got a 4-4 or 3-3 teaching load, plus independent study students, plus committees, plus all of that, you might find it bracing to the point of being vertiginous to come to a place where the expectations of you in terms of actual backside in the office seat day-to-day obligations are so liberal. The first time I taught for Fulbright, I said I taught at the University of Ghent, University of Liège, and University of Brussels. Wow. One course in the morning at the University of Ghent, one in the afternoon in Brussels on Monday. Tuesday and Wednesday were mine. Thursday, one afternoon in Liège. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday were mine. When I asked, this was 1,000 years ago, so there's a certain amount of safety in telling this story, do you want me to do office hours? Office hours were essentially an unknown at these schools except for professors there who had been in the American system. When I asked about joining in committees or doing special presentations, I often got genial but published puzzled looks. And what I mean to say is I was free and clear to do what I want, not to go and drink in the bistros, but to plunge into their libraries, go to their museums, cook up new dimensions to projects I had been vaguely interested in when I came over, and just kind of run free. You do work hard, I'm trying to say, but you're working hard at stuff that you want to do. And that in itself can be exhilarating. Have I gone too far, guys? Does that make sense?
No, that sounds fantastic. Thank you. Brian, how about you? What sort of benefits did you want to share and highlight with us about your experiences? It says you're self-muted. Did we lose him? There you go.
There we go. Dang it. Somehow. Anyway, I think I was double muted. Well, I mean, I want to second what Bruce is saying. And I also, and you hear in what he's saying, too, it isn't like it's vacation. You know, I mean, obviously, Bruce is this amazing scholar that's done all this work, so he's got the self-control to do it. When I went to Taiwan, one reason why they had not accepted me that first year at National Sun Yat-sen University was because the scholar who had gone before basically didn't do anything. But nobody ever said to him, they didn't say anything to him. They didn't want to sort of enter in and say, well, help us. So Bruce is exactly, in my experience, was the same way. I had to say that I'm here for you. What can I do to help you? And so that opened up so many doors because, again, I'm a guest in their world, right? But the biggest thing for me that I would condense here, that I always worked at little teeny schools that often I say, you know, like nobody's heard of, or, you know, enrollments of like 1,000, right? And so, and I loved it. It was my life. That's what I really did. And Bruce, I love corn too, right? I grew a Midwest guy, is me. But basically, the award, winning the award ultimately to me was about sort of legitimacy. I was at these little places where, you know, you develop this head trip where you're the only one teaching in the program, and so you think, well, they couldn't possibly, it would fall apart if I wasn't here. Well, no, you have to listen to what Bruce and Shirley have said. It's you reinvigorating yourself and getting out there and bringing all that information back to make it so much better for your students. The place will survive. without you, right? And so the legitimacy, though, was that when I was at Eureka, it wasn't really, luckily the president and the dean understood the Fulbright, but many of the other faculty were kind of like, a Fulbright, what is that? I don't know. It was the state university, it was Bradley University and Illinois State near me who were like, oh my God, you got a Fulbright? And I was like, yeah, I guess, I mean, suddenly I was like, legit. And I got to do all these awesome things like talk with Athena and Bruce and Shirley, right? And these people that I was, you know, just sort of in awe of before. And then I got to be an ambassador and be part of it. So the ability, the doors that it opened for me in terms of having that on my sort of card allowed me to show that, yeah, we're legit when we're at a little teeny school. We choose to be at that little teeny school. We just do different things, perhaps, you know. But it was that legitimacy that was the biggest piece. And the part that was that impressed me about colleagues and students is, you know, I really just let them know I was all in for them, and they trusted me, and it was so awesome because we just became so close. And, you know, they made me deputy director of the America Center, and I got to do all kinds of things with the embassy, and my project really was bringing American arts, promoting it in Taiwan. And so one of the things I developed was a thing called Discover America Month. And Kaohsiung was about the size of Chicago. And so I was given the ability to use all the arts institutions in the city and develop a month of arts festivities that promoted America in some way. So like Cole Porter and music over in Andy Warhol and art museums. And it was like I was using Chicago, you know, art facilities to promote America. I mean, where else would that ever happen?
And this I got to ask for Bruce. Did you talk about Mark Twain?
Yeah, there you go. I did. Indeed. One of the things I did, you're right, it's a good question, is I had one of the presentations was I had all these little short snippets read from different people like Mark Twain, Irma Bombeck, you know, different presidents and stuff. And I had the politicians and everybody in Taiwan come to it and read those things, right?
Good.
And so, yeah, it was great. And a lot of Mark Twain stuff. Man, he's perfect, right? He, Abraham Lincoln, they have all those great, it says everything. I'm not nearly as articulate as you might be able to tell as any of those individuals. So using them was great. So the theater piece of it, all that, it just made me feel more legit. And I don't mean in a evil head trip way. I just mean, I was like, yeah, that's right. I'm choosing to do this. I'm legit. And so when I'm at these small schools and teaching, yeah, I'm bringing something back to them and trying to show everybody else they could do it too. So if you're a small school, go for it.
Thank you.
Now on to Shirley.
Yeah, cultural ambassadors are definitely important part of that. So thanks. Yes, Shirley.
Yeah, I have to second everything Brian and Bruce are saying as well. And I, too, am from a small school, and I do agree with that, bringing a sense of legitimacy to your work. But when I looked at this and what it, I kind of looked specifically in those areas of research, teaching, and what it did. First of all, I think I still say that the Fulbright was life-changing in so many ways, meeting new colleagues, have new opportunities and research and things you bring back to the United States that impact your teaching, and especially continued connections and new connections on your trips when you go back to the country. So in the teaching end, I both in Keene, New Hampshire, and in Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, our students were pretty, they're in a pretty non-diverse setting. So my background has quite a bit of diversity in it, and a lot of my research is on diversity. And so I was able to integrate some of what I learned for them, as well as take some of the differences that I was learning from them and talk to my students. For example, without being all really political about it, just taking a look at how does patriarchy look in Georgia? How does patriarchy look in the United States? And they thought it was very interesting, both the Georgian students and the students that I have in the United States. In Georgia, I was modeling a more democratic approach to teaching with a lot more collaborative work with students and a kind of evening of the playing field so the teacher wasn't this all-powerful person. And that was really hard for them to kind of get used to, but they loved it. A few students actually talked to me about it. You're really fun as a teacher, you know. And I also, in the teaching, I'm currently supervising some doctoral students with a dissertation at the International University of the Black Sea, of which I had no connection when I did my Fulbright. But they get to know you, and they seek out people from scholars from other areas to help out. As far as research, I didn't really set up any specific research. I signed up for a teaching Fulbright, knowing that there would be opportunities there that I didn't really imagine at this point until I was immersed in the culture, and they did. And since that time, like, I published one article on English language acquisition. There were some LGBT rights issues that ended up in a published article, and a lot of international presentations. I've been involved in their biennial conference. I go back every other year to Georgia and help them out. And, you know, guest blogging on having them host, but a lot of things that I wouldn't have been doing at all. I couldn't see myself even doing that. But I think one of the strongest things was connection with your colleagues.
I'm sorry, Shirley, you're fading in and out. Can you repeat that?
I think one of the strongest things is the connections that you make with your colleagues.
Yes.
Can you hear me? Yeah?
Yes, I can. Uh-huh.
Just last night, a young scholar that I met during my return trips to Georgia wrote to me. I'd been encouraging her to try to come to the U.S. as a Fulbright. She's having an interview today. She's like, do you have any pointers, Shirley? Da, 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 da. You know, I've been able to help them out on grants and their conferences, on accreditation. And they're really growing as a nation and as educators. It's delightful to see this happening. It gets to the point, though, with colleagues. My husband and I are saying, we don't know what we're going to do when we return the next time, because we do sort of like our own space, and it's inexpensive to stay. You can rent a house for like $35 a night. And everybody's like, you have to stay with us when you come back. You have to stay with us. It's just amazing, the friendships and the warmth and the delightful relationships you build as a result of the Fulbright. I never would have done it without it.
Beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And one more kind of question to pose to our, reflection from our alumni so that we'd like to glean from them today. And we'll start with Brian, since the other two got first with that last time, those last two times. Here it is. What is the most important piece of advice for applicants regarding the application process? And we have a few questions already typed into the chat box, so please go ahead and keep populating those, and we'll go round robin. But let's hear some quick general overview of what would you have a room of a couple of applicants here, so what piece of advice?
Number one is don't be a weenie. Like, do it, okay? That's what I always tell people. It's the fear factor. People think, you know, because you have a doctorate, it means somehow you're not going to be afraid of doing these things. People come up with the weirdest logistic excuses to get out of it. Most logistics are just excuses not to do it. So don't be afraid. Go for it. And just talk with people. Talk to us. We'll help you. I always talk mostly to people in the application process about the personal statement, because I always believe that why you? Right? So what's the authentic story about that? So I told my story about that first-generation inner-city kid and how this would just transform. It's everything I've dreamt of to be able to get this and make this happen, and it would transform my family, which it has. And I just really tried to pour the feeling into that to show how committed I was to this making a difference in the world, and how I would try to spend my life kind of almost preaching about it. So that personal statement, it's not, you don't have much space or much, many words to put there, but I really focus on the why you, why are you doing this? And if it's about, well, because then I'll get promoted, see, not really probably the reason. It, you know, much more personal, powerful reason of why is what will push it over the edge, I believe.
Great. Thanks.
Sure.
Shirley, advice to add to that?
I'd say start early, especially if you need a letter of invitation. That's important to do, and there are contact people from the Fulbright at the bottom of each award. They may be able to offer some suggestions. The other thing that really helped me was to talk to other Fulbrighters. You can check with your grant office and see if they have listings of them. Check with online. You have access to other Fulbrighters on the Fulbright webpage, and we're more than happy to help you out with information. And then matching yourself with what they're looking for. So look at the award descriptions. Instead of saying, "Oh, I really want to go to this country," look for one that really matches what you're doing. That's what I did, the things that I was interested in that I could match up. And then look at the countries that present those things.
That's a very good point. I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. Were you finished with that, Shirley?
Yeah. Okay. That was pretty much it. I agree with what Ryan is saying. The other thing is just a point, and make sure you include everything. You can do all this hard work, but I've worked with a Fulbright on application reviews. There have been some really good applications that just had missing pieces despite being asked for them. Okay, so just do a double check before you send it in.
Great advice. But I wanted to say you brought up a very good point about finding that match. I tell people all the time, there's a Fulbright for everyone somewhere in the world, but there's not a Fulbright for everyone everywhere in the world. Meaning, like, a very important part of this process, and that's why that first question kind of touched upon that, when you picked your country and the award, you were really looking to find something that worked with what you were interested in doing, as well as something that fit to what the description of that country was really searching at that time, whether that's a priority field, whether that's something that they'd like to, a capacity that they'd like to build out in that country. So, yes, definitely thank you for that. And Brian's point about writing that those project statements. I mean, it's absolutely critical that that why is asked. There are a lot of different Fulbright. There are a lot of different funding opportunities out there. But what makes Fulbright, I feel, so unique is that mission of promoting mutual understanding, advancing knowledge across borders, and all of that. So there's a I use the three I's of Fulbright from time to time. This idea that the best Fulbright projects are innovative. They're doing things that may or may not necessarily be the standard protocol in a particular field or discipline, but they're exploring the innovative ways of researching and telling that story and teaching it. Particularly successful Fulbright grants are impactful. So you're talking about the benefits. We've heard some great examples here today of what you're bringing back to your home institutions. Are you creating new classes? Are you advancing your field? Are you writing chapters or books to it? That piece of what happens when you come back home is oftentimes just as important of what you're going to do in that country. So having a plan of what that'll look like, or at least addressing how that would benefit both, impact both your home and that host institution is important. And the last I would be inclusionary, or inclusion. So are you working with audiences that have robust levels of engagement with American scholars already, or are you going to be working outside of capital cities? Are you going to be working at institutions that might not have large amounts of English-speaking or American faculty at those institutions? How are you expanding this idea of cultural diplomacy and including audiences that might not have access to your type of expertise and knowledge base, I think, are three things that I encourage everybody to think about when writing their proposals. And Bruce, advice for you before we turn it over to question and answer?
I think you guys have really nailed it. The only thing I would add very briefly, it doesn't hurt to start looking at the Fulbright site and looking at the options and opportunities a couple of years before you think you might want to go. There are patterns that you can observe. There are situations where you see a good alignment between a continuing interest in some university elsewhere and what you do. Conversely, you can see situations where maybe they're You know, the elevator is already full of people who are doing things like you. Secondly, it's legitimate to open a conversation in a non-wheedling way with a colleague or a potential colleague at one of these schools to see if there is a good alignment between what you like to do and what they want. I remember we reviewed a case about 4 or 5 years ago. Professor, I think he was at Purdue, who studies the diseases of tulips. In his file was a letter practically in red ink from a professor at a university in one of the Dutch cities, saying, "We do tulips, it's our survival. We have this disease that he studies. For God's sake, send him over." That was a pretty persuasive document. Yeah. in that file. And make sure when you write your application that you're talking about what you can bring to it rather than what you can, you know, at least as much as what you're going to gain from it. So if you're writing the Czech Republic, you try to avoid anything that comes down to Prague, City of Dvorak, and Kafka. Write about what you think those students, those faculty, that environment can do for you and what you can do for them.
Great. Thank you. So I am... pulled up the questions that we have in the chats that have been typed in, and it looks like we have 5 or so questions. We have one that is, what did you do different in the second time to get the award? I think that might be referring to you, Brian. You mentioned that you applied to Taiwan and you didn't get it. What can you highlight a little bit about what was different that second time around?
Yeah, what was really interesting is, you know, the interesting thing about Fulbright is you don't really know, you don't get told why, you know, what your grade is at the end of it, right? I mean, people can help you some. But what happened was there's an American portion of screening portion that is done that Bruce and Shirley have spoken about that they've been part of. I was part of that at one time, too. And then the first time through, I got through that the American portion. Then it went to the country, and the country had to decide on yes or no, did they want me? And so I got a no. And I thought, well, forget this, because for a year, man, you're like wondering, should you renew, you know, your newspaper subscription, or are you going to go on this or not? It's kind of like you're hovering there. And so a number of the people who wrote letters for me said, you've got to do this. You made it past the American portion. You don't understand. And I didn't, really, because what I did then is I pursued more closely this particular university in Kaohsiung, and I found out, as I spoke about before, that really there had been someone before who hadn't really done a great job there, so they kind of turned, like, they hadn't wondered if they should even do the Fulbright stuff at that university. So then I felt even more to prove the point of how it was a legit program, and I could show them how much it could help them, and it was all about helping them. So it was because now I knew the circumstance at the particular university via somebody in that America Center who contacted me, and I was able to connect with them, that it kind of related to that sort of letter of invitation piece. They weren't required way back then like they are now, really. And so it was great because that's essentially what happened. Then I got the letter from them saying, we do want him, and here's what he can bring to us and what we need. Not exactly the tulip disease, but similar sort of thing. So I hope that answers it for you.
Great. Thank you. We have another question about housing. How was housing sorted out when you got a Fulbright? Bruce or Shirley, would either of you want to take that one?
Sure, I can talk about it. Okay, either one. Go ahead, Bruce. You talk about yours first.
No, yours is probably the more exotic experience. Let's talk about yours.
that was probably one of my higher stress things. They kept on telling me, don't worry, we'll find you something when you get there. And I couldn't find any examples of housing in the town online. If you were going to a big city, there were plenty of apartments in Tbilisi, but in town, nothing. So I just had to have faith. and I started in a little Airbnb and stayed there for about 5 days. And my boss, the lady in charge of the unit I was working in, we spent an afternoon. She went in and went to someone that only spoke Georgian, and we walked around town and saw three different homes, and I made a decision on which one I wanted to choose. So about a week afterwards, I had a place I was going to stay in. And they assured me that they would find me one, but I was really nervous about it. And they certainly did. They don't leave you out there so you don't have a place. It worked out fine.
That's a great answer, Shirley. Thank you. The long and short of it is that'll really depend on the country that you're going to. But yes, because we are affiliated with the Department of State, if there's not a Fulbright office in that country at one of our commissions, we do have staff on the ground at the U.S. embassies that might be able to help you. And in a lot of cases, in some countries, they actually have the institutions that are hosting you provide that housing for you. So it'll all of that is outlined in the catalog of awards. For more information. Great, and we have a question about what kind of community outreach did alumni participate in? So maybe this one's for you, Bruce. That might be both in country, but as well as back in the United States. What kind of outreach did you do to sort of enhance your experience as a Fulbrighter in country?
Well, all right, in country, I suppose most of it was doing office hours, which were enormous fun, and it resulted in a real breakthrough for me in my thinking. I found, again, how to put this gently, the students I had been working with there and also at other universities I've had the fun of visiting and teaching with in Western Europe are not used to being asked questions. They're used to a moi will speak and vous will listen kind of a situation. And so after they got over, I think, a certain diffidence in some cases, in dealing with the fact that you wanted a conversation with them, an awful lot of great stuff poured out. For example, I found out that humor and wit online, American, British, Irish, Scots, English language stand-up comedy, was an enormous source for the students I was working with, not just in finding out what we regarded as funny, but also in learning the actual vernacular of how we really talk. It's not unusual, I think, in a Western European situation to learn English in a kind of BBC English way. But if you can learn the patois of American humor, if you can listen to, I don't know, they came back with comic stuff that I didn't even know existed all over the web. And they were clearly getting the slang, sometimes good, sometimes a little sketchy, the vernacular, the ordinary way in which conversation, one-liners, asides, ebb and flow, how we use and don't use the language, the different intonations of voice, the cultural expectations and ententes we depend upon, how they found out a lot about that. And I found a lot about them and how they were learning about us. So that in-country, I suppose it was selfish on my part, but was striking up a conversation between professor and student, which at the large commuter campus I taught at more recently was a fresh thing for, I think, a lot of the students I work with. Afterwards, I got to put in a plug here. Fulbright, I think, is heroic on seeing to it that the program, that the awards do not fall into the closed loop that some other high-prestige awards have fallen into decades ago. It is not a closed system whereby one moves from the Ivy League school to the blue chip university abroad, back to the Ivy League, and then sends the protege. There's an awful lot of that that goes on. Conversely, Fulbright has Brian and I going out to universities and small colleges where there's a basic idea that, in fact, Fulbright is beyond those people. And that's not true. And in a lot of cases, there's a special eagerness in the review boards to pull the person from, you know, the less heard of state college in what they refer to in Boston as the flyover, rather than another person, you know, with another art history experience from the same school that's been chunking them out for other fellowships, you know, for since the beginning of the 20th century. There are 4,000 colleges and universities in this country, a couple of thousand community colleges. Fulbright people want to hear from them all. At least that's my impression, and they go to a lot of trouble trying to get connections out to those people. So it is, in fact, an American scholarship rather than a scholarship for a select few. So that's some of the outreach I know that Brian and I have been involved with, and it's a lot of fun.
Thanks. We have some. We have about 7 minutes until our time is up, but we have some very specific application questions, so I can go ahead and take those. There is this question about three separate institutions with projects, but all in one country. So what would we advise in terms of how to proceed? What I would do is I would reach out to all of them and see who gives you a sweeter offer, because one of those will ride to the top of the table, top of the list, if you will. One of them will seem more genuinely interested or more willing to work with you and provide and accommodate whatever classes you're interested in teaching or whatever research you'd like to do. So yes, I would absolutely contact all of them at the same time and say this is something you're interested in doing. And I don't think, as Brian, I think, touched on this earlier, or it might have been Bruce or even Shirley, contacting each of them at the same time should not be perceived as negative professionally. This is you going out and building your networks and just trying to get the work that you'd like to go out there done. So I would not consider that as something that would be detrimental to what you're trying to accomplish and getting. Self-promotion, I know, is hard for a lot of people, but I think it's definitely key in terms of building that network and strengthening that application. I'm just going down the list of the questions as they're asked. So the next one is, what are missing in the application when it does not even go through the first stage of the evaluation? If you're talking about the U.S. side of application process, if you don't make it past that first stage, it's a variety of reasons could be the case. One, those three I's that I talked about, every single one of those should be addressed, and if one of them is lacking or if one of them isn't articulated especially clearly, that could be a reason for why the application didn't advance. Another thing to consider is it's a competition. So maybe other people manage to make a better case to be in that country at any given time. So that's something to also take into consideration. What I do encourage people to do is to check the scholar directories and see who actually did get the award and see what fields they are actually represented in to give you a sense of what Bruce, that was a fantastic piece of advice he gave earlier. Do your research and see what the country has been sponsoring in recent years. Get a sense of whether, wow, I'm in a field that they haven't really looked at in 15 years, or, wow, I'm going to be the seventh scholar to continue to talk about this particular field at this particular institution in that particular country. All of that is very good information to put into your application process. And I'm trying to go down this list. While applying for the 21-22 academic and professional fellowship, can you start this grant under research for 9 months as of January 2002 to December, or does it need to start August 2001? It goes by academic calendar year in the country that you're applying to, so that's a question for the regional program staff. Depending on where the academic calendar starts in the country that you are going to, that's usually the indicator of when that grant can start. So that's a case-by-case basis. We have another question from Brian specifically.
Ooh.
What are the missing pieces on the American portion that may not have the application move forward?
Yeah, you answered that, really. I think it was more a negative of an example of sort of the first generation thing where I didn't have a network. Or you talked about that self-promotion thing. You know, when you're first generation, you don't have a network. So you have to self-promote, right? It's unless, like, what I try to do now is reach back to the people to help them, and that's why all of us are talking to you all today on this panel. And so I think it's the nuances is what we're missing, but more it was focused on the out of the country. It made it through the U.S. portion or whatever. It was outside the country. I just didn't even fully understand the politics or the sequence of those things. You know, Athena, I was thinking about a very quick one here, too, where an example where the Fulbright ambassadors in the old days when we would do things like travel and see people and face-to-face, remember? Anyway, way back in the previous decade. Anyhow, we... if I was ever at a school where it was smaller and there was somebody there who felt like the administration wasn't the most supportive of it, I always felt like that's where you could invite a Fulbright ambassador to come and through Athena work out the details if it's possible or not. But very often I was able then to speak with the president or whatever. I remember talking before with some of the other ambassadors, and I've like had that vice president title for so long, I don't really care. It's no head trip thing. But somehow at all those schools, they think of me as the equivalent. They don't think small school, huge school. So very often I meet with the president of that institution. And so the ability to meet with the president or the deans and talk about how important Fulbright is can kind of help you if you think you're especially at a place where you don't have that support. And that's where the ambassador program can come in. You can ask Athena more about that online.
Great. We have two questions that I think are very important questions that I want to take some time to discuss, but I know we only have 2 minutes. So we have one question from somebody who is not a professor at a university but has experience teaching at university level. And they're wondering if they would still be a good candidate for the Fulbright Award. And the answer is absolutely yes. This is, I think there's a lot of, this idea that our bread and butter obviously is the higher ed community, but if you have the skill set to teach at university level, that is what a majority of our partners overseas are looking for. They're looking for primarily faculty, but anyone who can go abroad to teach whatever their area of expertise is. And most of the world really expects you to be teaching in English, so language may or may not come to play. The exceptions to that will be in the Western Hemisphere might require some Spanish or Portuguese, but in Francophone Africa as well, some French there. But everywhere else, they're really expecting Americans to lecture in English, so please don't consider that as a hindrance. What I would say is definitely read those descriptions, because some countries will say, no, we're currently only open to academics at the moment, but we have this whole listing of opportunities available for professionals outside of academia who have that experience too. And lastly, does age or seniority negatively impact an application? That will depend on the country. Some countries are very adamant that they want only the most senior, most accomplished people in the fields who have already have a longstanding presence in what they're doing. Some countries will specifically say we're looking for emerging scholars, we're looking for early career postdoc scholars to really work with and sort of help them shape the trajectory of their career moving forward. The 800 opportunities and awards that we offer annually will have a spectrum of awards fitting that those two bookends, if you will. So seniority would not negatively impact your application in the case of what I would say are the more common mid-level upwards to senior distinguished level opportunities. And there is no age limit to the program, no. Shirley, Bruce, and Brian, is there anything else you'd like to add as sort of like a addendum to what you said or like a farewell?
Well, just as a footnote to what you just observed, which is absolutely right, senior, welcome. Senior, but on cruise control, maybe not so welcome. There are cases where we looked at scholars who had been at it for decades, who still, we could tell from their resume and their recommendations, had some fire left in their gut. And we saw other ones where there was, you know, we found too much evidence that the candidate was looking for a lounge chair with a view of the bay, rather than had anything genuinely to contribute or willingness to contribute as a scholar and a teacher. That comes out, I think, pretty clearly in the record, if the record's completed. So, yeah, if you're senior and you're still alive, definitely come. Yeah.
I was thinking about, I remember a few years ago, Athena, there was a study done where, on average, people would take 3 to 4 years before they'd actually apply for the Fulbright.
Yeah, that number's shrinking now. It's down to 2 to 4.
Oh, awesome. Okay. But see, still the look, think about it, not do it. Do it. It's fantastically amazing. You will never regret it. Do it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I agree with them. It took me 5 years. I didn't dare, but I just kept on looking and kept on trying. And I think the thing is, you know, just do it. You can, instead of saying, oh, I couldn't do it because of my dog or something like that, you can say, okay, I can do this. Now I have to figure out what to do with a dog, but do it in a positive sense. I can do this, and now I just have to solve these problems.
I think it's more urgent now than ever for a couple of reasons. One, I think America's under, again, I have to put this abstractly, an unusual pressure to show its best face, its most coherent and constructive dimensions internationally. And so it's very important to get the right people on the ground elsewhere. Secondly, we're drifting in, exacerbated by this pandemic, into an idea that the virtual is sufficient. It's great for something like this, but I don't want a generation growing up thinking that if you see something or if you quote unquote visit something on screens that you're having a genuine personal, you know, life experience. You got to get out there, shiver in the cold, get wet on the streets, argue with a landlady, eat the wrong food, and come back with something that's actual, valid, and real. And
right, it's the people knowing the people. It's not government knowing some other government. They know
exactly.
You as an American. They don't care about, I mean, you could talk all about the politics all you want, but it's people to people transforms the universe. It really does.
The actual teaching that you're doing in the classroom is only a very small part of the real value of the Fulbright, and you guys have clearly indicated that.
Beautiful. Well, the last bit of information I'd have to share is just what I've pulled up on screen. Stay in touch. Register for my Fulbright at cis2.org. If we didn't get to your question or if you'd like to dive a little bit deeper into any of this, email us at scholars@iie.org and we'll try to get your questions answered. And follow us on social media, LinkedIn, Instagram, all of that to continue the conversation. So from here in Washington, D.C., I thank you very much to our speakers for your continued contributions and commitment to enhancing and promoting the program in your daily lives and your various networks. So thank you all for that. And thanks also to the audience.
Bye, guys. Thanks
a lot.
Bye.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Take
Bye
care.
Now.
Stay safe, Bye. Everyone.